Welcome to Practical Faith, a podcast aimed at offering practical advice on how faith can help us with the complexities of everyday living. I appreciate your joining me. I'm Michael Brown. I have the pleasure of being senior minister at Marble Collegiate Church here in Manhattan, a local church with a global following. I'm so glad that you are part of that family. Today on Practical Faith, we have the wonderful opportunity to explore the spiritual meaning of the holiday season for Christians, Jews, those who are seeking spiritual depth and meaning in their earthly journeys. And I am joined by two very special guests. One is Sister Carol Perry, a gifted teacher and resident Bible scholar at Marble Collegiate Church, who has the gift of getting to the heart of complex faith issues and making them relevant and meaningful. And we also are honored to have Rabbi Joseph Potasnik, a radio host himself, for Religion on the Line on WABC. It's their longest-running show, correct?
Correct. 34 years.
34 years, where every Sunday he has multi-faith conversations about faith, religion, how they intersect our daily lives. Throughout our chaotic lives, particularly around the busy holiday season, we become less aware sometimes of the spiritual realities that are the foundation of the season. So it can be beneficial for us to take a moment and ask ourselves, what are the true meanings of these spiritual seasons that we celebrate? And how can we make sure we respectfully honor and celebrate that meaning with friends and family? This time of the year brings so many people together, whether family members, old friends, people of diverse faiths. So we're going to take a look at, explore together, how to be mindful in using our faith to ground us in the true meanings of these spiritual seasons that we call the holidays. Welcome, Joe, Carol. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
Our joy.
I want to start with you, Sister Carol, and ask, what is the true meaning, as you understand it, of Christmas? And how is this enriched by Christian and other than Christian perspectives?
The true meaning of Christmas really is very simple. It's a four-letter word, and we don't even know what it means most of the time. It's love. It is simply a manifestation of God's great love for us, that he wanted to join us on our human journey. It's interesting that the earliest Christians did not celebrate this season. Their concentration was on Easter. After the death of Jesus, it was his rising that focused them. But when Constantine took over in the Roman Empire in the early 4th century, he wanted something to replace some of the pagan rituals of the time. And he was looking for some way to latch on to a Christian message. He was a half-hearted Christian at best, but he was substituting Christianity for the old Roman peace. And so he decided that somehow this birth of Christ had to be celebrated. And I think like many festivals, it had its origin in something that's almost native. It was a pagan festival. It was light. And this dark time of year, when all of nature looks like it's going to be forever enveloped in darkness, the pagans celebrated the infinitesimally creeping light that made each day a few seconds longer. The darkness would not win. And so the early Christians, somewhere around the year 325, we think, decided to celebrate the birth of Christ, to tie it in with what had been the old Roman festival of light being reborn in the earth.
And so using perhaps the John story, a light shines in the darkness, the light of the world, that was an easy connect with their festival of lights.
Exactly.
Christmas, really, we have no idea when Jesus was born, right?
Absolutely none. I'm morally certain it was not in the middle of winter.
However, it was not in the bleak midwinter.
I think not. But it coincided with the winter solstice, and the date was chosen.
Rabbi Potasnik, yes. The Festival of Lights, as with so many other things, we got this from you. Tell us about Hanukkah.
And, well, firstly, thank you for giving us credit. You know, sometimes people take things from others and they don't give credit for it. But and I want to say it's a great honor to be with you, Dr. Brown. I consider you a close friend and colleague. And
you're my rabbi, right?
Well, you're my doctor. And I learn from you. And sister, it's an honor to be with you, given your impressive resume here at the church. And I understand a global resume. I'm sitting with two people who speak of love, love of tradition. And I think one of the mistakes we often make is when we convey the messages of our days, of our holidays, we don't stress the love enough. People sometimes turn to us for sad occasions. And I think they associate religion and sadness. Well, comes Hanukkah, and we say in Hebrew, mitzvah laharbos laora. It's a great mitzvah. It's a good deed. To bring light into the world. I was reading something recently which I thought was fascinating. You take a candle and you light other candles with it. Lighting other candles doesn't diminish the integrity of that one candle. I can light many candles. It does nothing in any way to take away from my candle. So here you have Christmas and Hanukkah juxtaposed, and we're able to stand together to talk about the other, to talk about our own, and it doesn't diminish the integrity of any of our holidays.
And the light theme in the heroes of the Muslim faith are called the luminaries of Islam.
Yeah.
This whole, which again comes from
Yeah, well, and you look at the story of Hanukkah, it's a simple story about Maccabees fighting against the Syrian Greeks, 2nd century BCE, we say before the Common Era. Fighting what? For the right to be free and practice their religion. The Syrian Greeks want to impose their way, and the Jews were saying, we want to be who we want to be. So, you know, that religious freedom we speak about is rooted in the very story of Hanukkah. And, you know, according to legend, there was only enough oil for one day, right?
And
it burned for 8 days because that gave them a chance to replenish the oil. Although I saw someone who came with a contemporary version of that. He said, you have the cell phone. It has a little bit of power left, and somehow miraculously the power lasts for, you know, an 8 day period, so you can recharge the battery at some point. But it's a story of true commitment to religious freedom, saying, you know, you can be who you want to be, but don't tell me who I want to be. We have that experience sometimes. You go out to eat with someone, and someone says, well, you got to have the chicken. I don't want the chicken. No, you got to have it. I don't want it. Don't order for me. You know, let me order for myself. So I think Hanukkah has a great great deal to say in terms of being independent, in bringing light into the world, at the same time recognizing the beauty of other lights mm-hmm. in the world. We certainly live in some dark times over the years, and anything we can do to bring some love and light to others, I think, is very welcome.
Okay, there's a great question that emerges from what you just said. How do our two traditions, for example, Judaism, Christianity, affirm one another in this season when Hanukkah and Christmas fall at the same time, or grow from, learn from, are augmented by the other's strength? What do either or both of you think about that? What's the complementary nature of the two?
They have to complement each other. The piece we Christians so often forget, and I have told my Sunday class this until they're tired of hearing me, Jesus of Nazareth was born a Jew, raised a Jew, died a Jew. The roots of Christianity are in Judaism. We are the same family. We're just a branch from your root. And if your root wasn't there, we would be anchored in absolutely nothing. And I think what happens so often is fear. People are afraid of affirming, as I am affirming you right now, because I firmly believe what I'm saying. We're afraid to affirm the other lest we lose something ourselves. Mm-hmm. We don't lose a thing. Your candle illustration was wonderful. It's exactly what we're doing. We're feeding each other's lights.
You know, I think we are living in a pluralistic society where you walk into so many buildings and seeing the Hanukkah menorah and the Christmas tree, next to each other is commonplace. Although I have to say this, the tree is usually much bigger than the Hanukkah menorah. But on the other hand, you know, somebody said Hanukkah doesn't hold a candle to Christmas. Christmas is a major, it's still a major holiday in Christian tradition. You're celebrating, you know, the birth of the Lord. Hanukkah is what we call a minor holiday. It's not major,
right?
Because it's not in the Bible. Any holiday that's not in the Bible, we don't consider major. And by the way, in New York, alternate side of the street parking is not suspended on Hanukkah, only on major Jewish holidays. But to be able to live in a country where Hanukkah and Christmas and Kwanzaa and other celebrations can be there side by side, I think it's a great statement of who we are. Let me tell you one quick story. Post 9/11, we who were involved in the recovery effort, and I was with FDNY as a chaplain, observed Hanukkah, Christmas at Ground Zero. And what happened was a tree was brought there, a tall tree, some 20 feet high, and a Hanukkah menorah at 9 feet high. Carpenters who were Christian, working for the city of New York, saw the disparity and said, we can't have this. We need to have two symbols of equal height. So they came on their free time. They weren't allowed to do it on city time. They came on their free time and built a platform. So the Hanukkah menorah would be just as tall as the Christmas tree. What message did that send?
A wonderful one, wasn't
right?
It?
Yeah, yeah. That you could be an equal in America. As you said, sister, you don't have to be defensive as to who you are. You could be proud of who you are. And I find that people who are committed to their own are also concerned about others, because they understand, you know, if I'm free, I have a responsibility that someone else should be free. So here we are, living in New York in particular, where Hanukkah and Christmas come together in so many different settings. And it really is, I think, a beautiful moment. I happen to attend the Christmas Mass at St. Patrick's every year, except when it's on Sabbath. And I go there and I listen to the music, and they know I'm Jewish. And I remember Ed Koch, when he was mayor, we would sit together, and Mike Bloomberg
was
yeah.
there.
And there we were, Jews, at a Christmas Mass. I thought of my parents looking down saying, what are you doing?
Right? You went through the wrong door.
Yeah, right. But on the other hand, how nice is it that we can celebrate with one another, yeah. about one another? And how many times has the Cardinal been to Hanukkah celebrations saying, this is our festival of lights with you? I think that's a great, great
we
commentary.
We worship the same God.
We do. We do. You know, somebody said to me years ago, if we take the train to Times Square, you'll take, you know, the 5 train, I'll take the 2 train. We're going to end up in the same destination. How we get there, a little bit different, yeah. right?
You and I have done a lot of weddings over the years, and we always talk with the couples about whatever the issues might be. When you do an interfaith wedding, what do you share with a bride and a groom who are, say, Jewish and Christian, and neither is going to convert to the other's faith, but they're going to live in the same home and rear the same children? What counsel do you advise?
Think twice. You know, are you sure you want to do this? Look, the ideal setting, as you know, is where two people share a common faith, mm-hmm. where there is mutuality. And that's not always the case. And I think what we try to do is to say to them, let's find some common ground here. Let's find some common ground. But I also apprise them of reality. And reality is that when you have children, being a hybrid is not a great place to be both Christian and Jewish simultaneously, because what ends up happening is you dilute one or both, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. So if there can be a decision made about how we're going to raise children, that takes a lot of pressure. But in order to do that, both have to be knowledgeable in the faith. So I find it's difficult, but as you know, we call it Chrismukkah, right? Where they're celebrating both. We recognize the reality, and we try to get people to understand common rootage, as sister mentioned. But at the same time, there are going to be some conflicting moments, and people have to learn how to resolve conflicts in a constructive fashion. Not easy, but that's the world in which we live.
of course, not everything's easy in marriage anyway. Yeah. So that would just be, Carol, you have people of faith other than Christian come into your weekly Bible lectures. So in this season of the year, when you're talking about the birth of Jesus and the meaning of Christmas, what keeps them coming, and how do, what do they ask, and how do they plug in all this?
I think people of such varied backgrounds, as you mentioned, I think one of the core components of our human nature is questioning. And we have a lot of good questioning people out there who, for all kinds of reasons, don't belong to any organized religion. Many of them are simply looking for information. I think that's sort of the most casual level, if you will. But I think if they have met a true believer of whatever faith, they want to know what makes that person tick. You know, someone once said to me, "You have something I don't have. You have faith. Where did you get it? How can I find it?" And faith depends on knowing something. It's not just blind faith. It's knowing faith. And so for some people, it's this genuine curiosity to find out what can move people, intelligent people, to come to a religious belief and not lose their humanity. I think so often they think religion means brainwashing.
Yeah, yeah.
You must meet that.
I do. I meet a number of young people who have a void. They've made it professionally, and I'm sure you've encountered this as well. They're very successful, top of their game in their professional lives. And they'll say to you, "I feel something is missing. I feel still disconnected. And in the world of technology, I feel even more disconnected." So they're looking at faith traditions for something to give them a sense of belonging, community. We've used the word community so many times because people need community. You know, Sinatra used to sing, "I gotta be me." We say, "I gotta be we." It's all about the plural. It's all about living. The Hebrew word for life, chayim, is in the plural. You cannot say life in the Hebrew language in the singular because you gotta live surrounded by others. And I think with young people today, with all people, not just young people, they're coming searching for meaning, but they're also searching for community. They want to be surrounded by others who have similar concerns and similar problems and similar challenges. At the end of the day, we feel we belong to one another.
Which is where you started earlier with this four-letter word, the whole idea that love brings us together, and that is such a huge component of community. In this season where our faiths are central to us, but not to everybody, where for many it's sort of the decor, the parties, the shopping, the whole ambiance of the season, but not securely attached to spiritual roots. Start with you, Carol. We hear the phrase, "Keep Christ in Christmas." How do we do that? How do we, in the family setting or in our circles of friends, make certain that faith is not somehow dismissed from December?
There's this awful temptation, and the media helps it, that if your celebration isn't worthy of Hallmark, it's not a good celebration. And this is where I think those of us of faith have something to offer the world. It doesn't have to feel like let's all go home for Christmas and love each other around the turkey table. I mean, and I'm sure you get something of the very same thing. Sure. That's not what this season is about. It's really about understanding that we're very flawed people, all of us, and recognizing that fact. And yet, if we can put two flawed people together, we might end up with a whole person. And so it's this community we've been talking about, where you can be respected and honored for who you are, regardless of the fact that you are not the perfect person, that you don't fit the definition of perfection. I think that's one of the gifts that organized religion sometimes does not give its constituents. You don't have to be perfect to come to church. Mm-hmm. Church is not for the good people. I taught a course on that this year.
Yeah.
Church is for the bad guys.
Yeah, I've come not to call the righteous but sinners to repentance.
Exactly.
Yeah, you know, I've always thought, Joe, that you do a better job of this than we do. You know, I think about during Passover and the Seder meal. Some of your holy days and your observances are so centered on the retelling of your faith story, where ours sometimes gets centered on a thousand things but that. What about Hanukkah?
Well, you know, we have some similar problems. The commercialization of holidays, where Hanukkah for many becomes gift giving. Nothing more than getting gifts.
It's the
not
fault.
The giving, right?
It's the fault of our Christmas.
Yeah.
It edges into
what am I
going to
get? Not what am I going to give, what am I going to get? You and I, Doctor, had a wonderful conversation this past week about the meaning of being religious in society. Now, some people say you define religion by how many times, how many hours you spend in the house of worship, keeping certain commandments. But what about the people who don't come to church, who don't come to synagogue, and yet are there for the coat drive, for the homeless shelter, mm-hmm. right? Visiting in hospitals as volunteers, are they not religious? And you know, you talked about which door did you go into before with St. Patrick's. Well, people walk into houses of worship or walk into the religious setting through different doors. Not everybody comes through the front door. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to be very welcoming and recognize that there are different responses, different stimuli, and people come for a host of reasons. And we have to be just as welcoming, just as warm for those who may not have a good attendance record on Sunday, but you know, the rest of the week, they're doing some very, very important things, some mitzvahs, as you would say, Doctor. Mm-hmm. They're doing mitzvahs in bringing light into the world. So I think, yeah, it's important to tell the story, but we also have to tell the story in what it means today. What does it mean, you know, to talk about the Maccabees fighting for their faith? What it means to me is very simple. When I hear about a Muslim who's attacked on a train because she's wearing a hijab, mm-hmm. or it was a woman, a police officer was attacked right. wearing a hijab. When I see a swastika in a park, that's Hanukkah saying to me, you better fight for those people. You've got to stand up and say something. You've got to bring some light into the world because it's dark for them right there, you know, when they're being attacked. So faith plus action. What are we going to do? Belief is measured by behavior. So I think that Hanukkah has a great message, as Christmas has a great message, not in just what we say, but what we do.
Yeah. We're hearing more of the Niemöller quote now, and since the hate crimes are beginning to escalate somewhat, that ended up, of course, with the famous statement, at last they came for me and there was no one left to speak out.
But I think it's, you know, I think we can be comforted by the fact that people are speaking out. Although the woman on the train said that no one there, but what a response afterwards, where people said, how can we help? What can we do? We were talking at the Board of Rabbis about getting clergy together with that young woman and taking a solidarity train ride and saying, you know, we're in this together. You attack her, you attack me. Billings, Montana, 23 years ago, was the scene of a lot of hate. What happened one day was a rock went through a window of a five-year-old child's bedroom celebrating Hanukkah. The town came together and said, we're all going to put menorahs in our windows, all of us. Now, Billings is not known for having a large Jewish population. Mm-hmm. What happened? The hate crimes stopped. Mm-hmm. People responded. Matter of fact, someone said to the sheriff of the community, is it dangerous if we put menorahs in the window? He says, it's a lot more dangerous if you don't do anything. So when people do respond, and they are responding.
They are
we
responding.
Do. People, we can't, in good conscience, close our eyes to the tears that people are shedding out there. So I think it's heartening on one hand. What we're seeing is disheartening when we have these attacks, and there's been an increase in attacks, but we're not going to remain quiet. We're not going to let the light go out.
And I think, if I'm not mistaken, faith in Hebrew is a verb.
Yes.
Not a noun. And right. I think that's a very important thing for us to remember at this season. We are all being called to be active, as you just said, Rabbi. That's extremely important.
So not just to articulate faith, but to live faithfully.
Live faithfully, exactly.
You know, our marketing and communications department here continues to send me things they're picking up the holiday season from merchants that are doing this year TV advertisements about cross-cultural kindness. And it's been wonderful to watch. It was H&M and Amazon and McDonald's. And there are about five of them that we see frequently now on television that are just simply statements about extending kindness across faith boundaries, racial boundaries, orientation boundaries. And it's really lovely to see what you just said, that society is stepping forward and saying no to hate in some very visible ways.
I came to New York years ago, and the Christmas tree at Rockefeller Center was lit that year by Sam Levinson. Now, Sam Levinson, humorist, is a Jew.
Yes.
So he stood up.
He's also a school teacher, Carol.
Very good.
So he stood up and he said, I'm sure some of you are asking, why am I a Jew being selected to light the Christmas tree at Rockefeller Center? And he said, but let me tell you, when I was growing up on the Lower East Side, there was a kind gentleman, Christian, who would come into our home Friday night and Saturday and put on the lights for us, turn on the stove, because we were religious and we were not allowed to kindle on the Sabbath. So this Christian gentleman would do it for us. We never knew how to repay him. He wouldn't accept any money. So I today want to say thank you to that Christian for putting the lights on in our home, and I'm going to put the light now on this Christmas tree in Rockefeller Center. So extending that light, you know, of kindness to one another is something that I think we need to replicate as often as possible.
Tell me what you see to be the connection between Passover and Lent.
Between Passover and Lent, well, Passover is replete with prohibitions, things I cannot do, I cannot eat. Right? I have to make some sacrifices. And I'm doing it for a higher purpose. I'm showing my commitment to God by saying, I don't have to have all the things I normally have. I'm going to demonstrate that I love my tradition, even though I can't enjoy some of the things I have the rest of the year. Right? I mean, you're giving up all the bread ingredients and eating that Passover food. And some of the Passover food, the jellies, are not the most delicious. A dentist may approve of it, but some of us don't enjoy them. But I think, you know, contrary to the Hanukkah Christmas story about the giving of gifts, it's not about what we get. It's about what we give. And the idea of giving things away that we normally have, the idea of serving God with joy when you don't have all of the comforts, eating matzah, you know, is how much matzah can you eat after a while? But look at, you're eating matzah surrounded by your family and friends at a Seder table. Mm-hmm. It gives you a reordering of priorities, tells you this is where you should focus your attention on these people. Who's around you? Who's at the table? Somebody told me years ago, life is like leftover turkey. It's very easy to sit at the table on Thanksgiving Day when the bird is stuffed to overflowing. Everybody's there. What happens the day after? The day after, people are returning to their areas. You may be at the doctor's office not feeling as well as you did before. It's learn to live with leftovers, right? And I think Passover is, yeah, there's a lot of stuff you can't have. You got to learn to live with leftovers. You got to learn to live with things that you normally don't have to live with. And I think there's commonality with Lent there, isn't there?
Right.
Yeah, Carol, what is the commonality with Lent then?
Well, I think, you know, the rabbi expressed it very well. In Lent, we're asked to, in some way, look at our lives and be a little more mindful of the spiritual journey. Mm-hmm. It's a vital part of us. And sometimes, as you said so well, it gets lost in everything else that's going on. And so we're asked to take 40 days, which is that wonderful biblical symbol for a long time, and live differently so that the end result will be maybe a new joy in rediscovering the old tastes and flavors. But along the way, we've learned that we can live with less if need be, for a greater reason.
Do you remember with our kids, when they were young, we used to buy them all these toys, spend a lot of money, go to Toys R Us, buy them everything, and they played with them, and after an hour or so, but they took that ball, bouncing ball, the simple ball, you know, the balloon, and they were fixated on that much more than all those expensive toys. Mm-hmm. I think we have to recognize that there are things in life that are much more meaningful. And we don't need all of the, you know, the ornate stuff, but the simple things of life are really, the little things are the big things. Mm. Passover teaches us that. Lent teaches us that. I think all holidays, because they're all focused on family, friends, community. And maybe it says to us, instead of looking to buy all the stuff, look to surround yourself with people who mean so much to you.
So in those two seasons, and we talk a lot about fasting, which is really this whole general, what can I live without? And what do I put back in its place, which it sounds like is a deeper awareness of our faith roots, spiritual roots, biblical roots. Would the season we're in now, Hanukkah, Christmas, and all the commercialism, would it be improved if it had a little bit more of Passover and Lent about it?
Well, I think a piece of the gift giving should be is we are looking to bring joy to someone else by maybe giving up something for ourselves. The money I would spend on myself, I'm going to use to buy a toy for that kid in a homeless shelter. Mm-hmm. I think that's part of the true gift giving. It's not, you know, I have to give a present to Cousin Charles because he always gives a present to me. I don't think that has anything to do with the season. It's some of these things we get trapped into. But the whole idea of gift giving is it's got to come from some sacrifice, if you to use that term, which is a good religious term, on our part to bring joy in the true meaning of the season to somebody else who can't have it without our doing it.
We're all on Facebook. Story on Facebook recently of a young boy who's in Texas. Bar mitzvah celebration, and he said he had all the gifts, a lot of money. I think it was $25,000 in gifts. He says, I am taking the money and I'm buying sneakers for kids who can't afford to buy sneakers, for families who don't have the funds. And he gave his entire amount, right? It was a mitzvah project for him. We insist when kids have bar and bat mitzvahs that they have a mitzvah project. Because it's not a day when you're just going to, you know, collect. It's a day you're going to give. The biographer of the Duke of Wellington, before he did the biography, he said to the Duke, let me see your checkbook. He said, why do you want to see my checkbook? He said, because I want to see the causes you supported. If I'm going to say you were charitable, I want to see the receipts. And I think all of us have to learn, we need to have receipts. We need to do for others. And I can't think of anything that is a more of a teaching moment for young people than on this special day, you're partying, you're, you know, having a great time, you're dancing. Well, there are other kids who are not dancing and not partying and don't have what you have. Bring a little bit of light into their lives.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
The last statistic I saw, and they changed by the day, but was that in our country, there are 123,000 teens and preteens who sleep beneath bridges. Now, that didn't take into account the shelters and the, you know, they too are homeless. But, on Christmas morning, when some of our children are surrounded by so many things, like you said, Joe, they can't even appreciate them. It's too many to appreciate.
Right.
Maybe a great lesson would be to teach our children the joy that comes through giving as opposed to receiving. Let me ask each of you in this season of faith and rejoicing, family, friends, all that goes with it, what are some takeaways, not just from this podcast that we can be thinking about, which is important, but as we enter a new year, as we get into January and February and May and September, what can we take from this that should live with us and can help change our lives a bit? Let me just start with the rabbi.
You know, I'm glad you have sister here, because when I hear someone known as sister, I think of my own parents who arrived in Lynn, Massachusetts after the war. They had lost 5 children in the Holocaust. I'm a product of their second marriage. They lost their spouses then as well. The first group to reach out to them were the nuns of St. Mary's Church in Lynn, Mass. And every year at the Seder, we'd have the nuns there because they helped my family rebuild their lives to teach them to start again. And So I grew up in a home where I learned that if you don't do for others, your life is incomplete. And Jewish tradition says if you only pray for peace for yourself, it's an incomplete prayer. So I think all of us, this time of year, have to ask ourselves, you know, what are we doing to help those who really need our help? I was on a bus in New York, and on the bus, there was someone sitting in front of me, his eyes were closed during the entire bus ride. And we both had to get off at the same stop, and I turned to him, I said, can I ask you a question? I noticed that when I was standing there, your eyes were closed the whole time. Any particular reason? He said, oh yeah. He said, I hate to see women stand. He said, by keeping my eyes closed, I didn't see women standing, so I didn't have to give up my seat, right?
Now, good Lord.
You know, you look at that, you listen to that, and you say, wow, it's true. Those who close their eyes don't see tears. And I think the takeaway for us is let's not keep our eyes closed and our ears closed to the real pain that's out there. You mentioned that statistic. We, in good conscience, we are people of conviction. Cannot be comfortable knowing that there are those who are sleeping under bridges, those in shelters, when a little bit of help from all of us could transform their lives. I know the nuns did it for my parents, and I think we can do it for others too.
Sister Carol, what are some takeaways?
I think it has to be a rebirth of hope. Otherwise, our faiths mean absolutely nothing. And I think one of the grave dangers of the modern society is with all this emphasis on I, me, mine, we lose sight of those other people. You're absolutely right. We go around with our eyes closed, if not literally, figuratively. If I don't see them, I don't have to respond. And I think it's a time of enormous political uncertainty, and that creeps into our religious lives as well. And you have to think back to those first Christians. People could pick them out on the street because they said, see how these Christians love one another. I'm not too sure you can pick us out on the street these days.
Well, you can do it at Marble Collegiate. Let me give a little promo here. I'll tell you what, I told this to Dr. Brown. I walked by twice this past year at the conclusion of the service, and I saw people standing in line waiting to say hello. And you stood there with other members of the clergy, and I understand you have clergy stationed different places.
Yeah.
And for a moment, there is that exchange, that the hand, the hug. And I said, wow, that's lacking in a lot of lives. There are a lot of people who don't get a hand and a hug. We can't minimize that. And I think all of us in our own way, you know, a simple greeting in an elevator. Hey, how are you? Nice to see you all. Even though you don't know anybody. I know some people get frightened by that, but it's nice. You say to someone, you look great today. Even if you don't mean it, it's a nice thing to say. Art Buchwald, years ago, was in a cab, and his friend, he was getting out, he said to the driver, you're a great driver. You are terrific. His friend said to him later on, what was that about? He said, you know, by my saying that to him, I know the next person getting in is going to be treated so nicely. Right? The camera's going to feel so good. He's going to greet the next person. How are you? That's what we have to do. We have to be lamplighters. You know, we talk about lights. We got to bring those lights. Light other lights. Bring a little bit of joy into people's lives.
I have an acid test for churchgoers, all houses of worship, synagogues too. I love to walk past on Sunday mornings and watch them come out. And if they are not coming out smiling, that place failed.
And if they're running out, that's a problem.
Oh, that's even worse.
Holding their wallets.
We have something to give the world, those of us of faith. Mm-hmm. And we've got to give it. That's what God's ultimately going to say to us on the Great Judgment Day.
They're probably not going to find elsewhere.
Right.
Yeah.
What did you do with what I gave you?
And they're not going to find it on Facebook. In a complete fashion. Yes, it's a connection. It's a way of reaching people you normally, but you still need to know. When I'm in a difficult place, let's say I'm lost a loved one in a mourning, it's nice that people send me messages on Facebook, but I need someone to lift me up.
Yeah.
Right? When I'm celebrating a special moment, like you get to the airport, isn't it nice when somebody's there to pick you up? Someone's there for you, rather than you walking alone and you get the cab on your own. That's why I always made it a point, pick up my son. I used to put his name on a piece of paper, like the driver, you know, coming to pick you up on the, at the airport. That's who we need. We need to be there for one another.
You remember Leo Buscaglia, who to me was just heroic, who said, find love, find life. But he would, as you recall, at the end of his lectures, would come off the stage and just say, you know, we're done for the night, but if anyone wants a hug. And they said that people would line up, and the line for the hugs inevitably took a lot more time than his lecture had. And he said that it was just remarkable what would be whispered in his ear when he hugged somebody. But someone would say, you know, I haven't had a physical touch since my husband died, or I've lost my job or lost my home, and I needed a moment to be cradled and things like. And it was the sort of thing you were talking about, Joe. That when the people come out on Sunday morning, and I know when they come out of your class, Carol, they want to make contact with you, because even beyond the words that we've said, there's the presence with them and the touch.
Do you remember that scene of the young girl? I think it was in New York. The Pope was visiting, and this young girl with flowers. Mm. And she was trying to get to the Pope, right? And security was holding her back. And the Pope saw, and he said, and he hugged her. And it was, for her, a transformative moment. And I think of how many people are so lonely in their lives. And a simple gesture, like reaching out. You know, as I say, that candle, you can light others. It doesn't take away anything from your own. You can bring happiness to others. It doesn't diminish yours. On the contrary, it even increases it.
Yeah, it just makes the whole symphony of light brighter. Yeah. Well, I find real, and I find faith, and I find the fingerprints of God in the two of you. I'm so honored that you spent a few minutes chatting this afternoon and informing and inspiring those of us who eavesdropped on your conversation. And to those of you who are listening, as we near the holidays, I invite you to take a moment, explore your own faith, how to become more aware of what this season is truly about while in the company of our loved ones. From all of us here at Practical Faith, we hope you have a wonderful holiday.